This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Jared Hill, in for Steve Chiatakis. About 600,000 Los Angeles Unified students are headed back to school this week, virtually. That's a lot of families trying to figure out how to make distance learning work better in the fall than it did in the spring, when many children didn't get the education they would have if they were in their physical classrooms.
So a mí me llenó de frustración como madre.
As a mom, this filled me with frustration, Mireya Pacheco says. She's got three girls in LAUSD school spanning from fourth grade to 12th grade. The Pacheco family did their best in the spring.
Well, it was kind of difficult because some of the things we wouldn't understand, and the teacher would like try to explain it, but it just wouldn't be the same thing as learning it during class.
That 17-year-old Midiari Pacheco. What worried the Pacheco parents the most was their middle daughter, Osana. See, the family immigrated from Mexico, and they speak Spanish at home. While Osana can speak English with her friends okay, to cope with schoolwork, she received English language tutoring provided by her school and required by law. Osana is one of 120,000 LAUSD students in this boat. That's one in five of all of the district's children. They're called English learners, or ELs, and schools are required to provide them with special instruction. But in the upheaval of the pandemic, many didn't get that. Now that school administrators have had the whole summer to figure out how to do online learning better, Mireya Garcia Pacheco wants to know if her daughter will get the help she needs. Reporter Deepa Fernandez picks up the story in the small dining area of the Pacheco apartment in Pacoima.
It's a sticky, still afternoon when I meet the Pacheco family. They're clearing up after lunch.
Tomate.
Tomate.
Chiles.
Mireya Pacheco and her three daughters have been sorting the apartment to be ready for when school starts.
Yo todavía me siento preocupada. No sé cómo le vamos a hacer.
I'm worried. I don't know how we will do it. We don't have enough space after they told us all to stay home. We live in a two-bedroom apartment, and I'm trying to figure out how to reconfigure the living room as an office space so that my three girls can all be in their classes and have what they need.
Para que ellas puedan tener lo necesario.
As eldest daughter, Miriari, clears dishes away, she says she basically holed up in the bedroom to do her class Zooms during the spring.
Sometimes I just do it with like my sleeping clothes on, and I'll just brush my hair.
The logistics of who will sit where to do schoolwork are just one of this family's concerns. When the pandemic hit, Dad lost work, and their income disappeared. The family computer was not new enough to run Zoom, and when they finally got Chromebooks from their schools, the internet connection couldn't support all three kids Zooming simultaneously. Then there's juggling the schoolwork. Mom and Dad don't speak much English, so they can help the girls with Spanish.
Estoy comiendo una fruta.
Una fruta.
Una fruta.
And Miriari helped Hosanna with reading and writing in English.
Like, it's difficult for her to learn English.
English learners like Osana number some 1.1 million across California. The state mandates that school districts provide these students with special instruction to accelerate their language acquisition. It's not an easy task, as English learners are a diverse group. Some students have very little ability to communicate in English. Then there are students like Osana who speak and understand, but struggle to read and write.
Most need help with math. In English. I have my sisters to help me.
After support from their school, English learners are expected to be able to learn enough English to stop receiving special services. Osana's mum, Mireya, says her daughter was almost at that point when the pandemic hit.
Ella estaba recibiendo tutoría. Antes de que pasara la pandemia,
my daughter was receiving tutoring before the pandemic from a very good teacher. But after COVID hit, she didn't get a single service to help her with her English.
No, no recibió nada.
She didn't get anything.
The spring really knocked everyone for a loop.
Karen Muhlberger is the director of the upper elementary grades at Vaughan Next Century Learning Center, the LAUSD charter school where Osana completed fifth grade. She says there were so many challenges when students were ordered to learn from home, like getting all children online. Her team did its best for their EL students, she says, and they have a good plan in place this year.
We will be having 40 minutes of face-to-face learning, direct instruction each day.
Sandy Mendoza, director of programs at a local parent advocacy organization called Families in Schools, hopes all English learners will get this attention.
We're not certain that English language learner needs are being addressed fully. I mean, they were already challenged by this before the pandemic.
Families in Schools conducted a survey of over 300 families.
We had a 70% responding that they didn't feel the spring experience was really addressing Spanish language learner needs. And we know that if that's a concern in the spring, it has to be more serious in the fall.
Many parents of English learners are trying hard to advocate for their children, Mendoza says.
Parents, because of their experience in the spring, were trying to bring forward some of their concerns. And a lot of that was doesn't feel like it was heard because they weren't included in the conversation.
There were no EL parent voices when the teachers' union and district officials hashed out the fall plan. Nor were English learner families included in the working groups convened to flesh out how fall learning would occur, Mendoza says.
Even the work groups that are being brought together to talk about in real time how it's working in the virtual classroom, their voices are not even included at the table.
It's something to be vigilant about, says civil rights attorney Anurima Bhargava.
When a population of students, like English learners, doesn't have the opportunity to participate meaningfully and equally in school, it is a civil rights issue.
Bhargava served as the chief of the Educational Opportunities Section at the Justice Department during the Obama administration. She has direct experience with California failing its EL students in the recent past.
So in 2016, the Justice Department reached a settlement requiring California to comply with federal law and fulfill its obligations to monitor and make sure public schools were providing language services to the approximately 1.4 million English learner students across the state.
There is a support division at the California Department of Education that is tasked with doing just that. Director Veronica Aguilar says she feels hopeful about the possibilities of distance learning. For one thing, students can access online translations in real time. Also, Zoom allows a teacher to section kids into groups based on where they need help.
If you've seen a classroom where there's math teaching and you have students, but a few of them are English learners, you would have instruction that where you pull them aside. Same thing with distance learning. You have the ability, like in Zoom, where you can have that one-to-one with the student or small group instruction.
The state ran a series of distance learning trainings for teachers of English learners this summer. That's just the beginning, Aguilar says.
So we have more to come. By no means have we provided enough guidance and support.
It's como un plum.
In the Pacheco's Pacoima apartment, where mom Mireya spent the spring doing school supervision and trying to earn some extra money, she started collecting cans and bottles to recycle for a few dollars. She's gearing up for this double duty again. And she has her doubts that school officials will prioritize students like Osana.
Yo la verdad me siento frustrada.
The truth is, I feel frustrated. Sometimes I feel like schools are not really giving students what they need. They focus more on the kids who are doing much better.
Entonces no, creo que no es justo.
I don't think this is fair.
Osana Pacheco and LA County's 250,000 English learner children will be counting on schools to get it right. For KCRW, I'm Deepa Fernandez.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Jared Hill. The Democratic Convention kicks off tonight at 6 p.m. local time. Normally, it's a huge shindig.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
That fills a giant convention hall with delegations from all the states and plenty of pomp, circumstance, and balloons. But tonight's speakers, including Michelle Obama and Bernie Sanders, won't be speaking to a hall full of excited delegates. They'll just be talking to the camera and folks watching from home. Like all her Democratic colleagues, Congresswoman Karen Bass would normally be there in that throng of delegates in a packed convention hall, but not this time. She represents parts of West and South LA. She chairs the Congressional Black Caucus, and she was a finalist to be Joe Biden's running mate as the nominee to be vice president. And Congresswoman Bass joins us now. It is a great honor to have you join us. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. So I'm sure you've been to a whole lot of Democratic conventions, but this is going to be a weird one. Can you kind of explain how it's going to work?
Yes, it certainly is going to be strange, and I wish we could all be there together because there is so much excitement behind our ticket and the fact that we're 80 days away from the election. But basically, you know, all of the caucuses and all of the committees that normally meet will be meeting. They will be meeting over various Zoom calls, and then, of course, the main events will take place in the evening. And so it will be exciting nevertheless. I mean, and if you think about it, the majority of the American people have always watched the convention from their living room. And so this really won't be any different, except for the activists or the core of the Democratic Party leadership that attend in person.
So in 2016, I was in Philadelphia covering that convention, and I know there was a lot of enthusiasm that came out of that convention. Do you worry about enthusiasm coming out of this year?
Oh, no, because again, just think about it. There might be, let's just say, 20,000 people that attend the convention. Well, there's millions of Democrats. And I think that the enthusiasm is there because people understand the significance of this election. And the way I describe it is this election is a matter of life or death. 160,000+ dead Americans that didn't have to die, but because of the lack of leadership from this administration, the excitement of our ticket, especially the addition of Vice President nominee Kamala Harris, especially coming out of our state, I think the enthusiasm is going to be there regardless of what form the convention takes.
Okay. Well, turning attention from the convention back to your regular work in Congress. You and your colleagues are on a break right now, but House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is calling you back this week to deal with the Postal Service. 3 weeks ago, we had LA County Registrar Dean Logan here, and he was saying on this show that every California voter would be getting a mail-in ballot sent to them. But can we depend on those if we use them? How are you advising your constituents on that?
Well, the number one thing is the minute you get that ballot, fill it out right away, because I am not as worried about California as I am other states, because we have such excellent leadership here and we're not going to allow certain things to take place. But the post office, you know, of course, is under federal jurisdiction. And so just to be on the safe side, filling out your ballot as soon as you get it, because then there will be no excuse in terms of a delay of the vote. If you get your ballot and you decide to fill it out and mail it in on November 1st, well, we might be in trouble. So fill it out as soon as possible. Now, we are going back to vote on Saturday because the president said he will sign a standalone bill, making sure that the post office has enough resources. But we will see, because the president says that one minute, and by the time Saturday comes, he might have 10 different positions. And then we go back there, and it depends on whether or not he allows his staff person, Mitch McConnell, to bring it up for a vote in the Senate. We know that Mitch McConnell has abdicated his role. He no longer acts as the president of the Senate. He acts as a staff person of the of President Trump. So if President Trump allows the Senate to vote, then yes, the post office will get the resources. Then we are still not going to be able to let our guard down, because having the resources does not automatically mean they will be spent and implemented in the way that we will vote and in the way that we dictate.
So a lot of your constituents here in LA, like all Americans all over, have been hit hard by COVID-19. And you talked about the numbers of people that have died. A lot of people got very sick, and many other ones have lost their jobs. Some are struggling to put food on the table right now, and they're worried about the possibility of getting evicted or losing their homes. That $600 a week unemployment boost that came with the CARES Act ended a couple of weeks ago, and now Congress has gone on break until September without a deal on more help for people and businesses that need it. What are you telling folks in your district who are in desperate need of federal assistance?
Well, you know, the sad thing about it is that in the House, as you know, we voted on all of that assistance almost 3 months ago. And because the president has not decided what he wants to do, the Senate has not acted. And so I really was sure that the Senate was not going to allow people's unemployment insurance to run out. But needless to say, I was wrong. They feel that $600 a week is allowing people to have so much money that they don't have the incentive to go back to work. I find that to be so insulting that $600 a week does not recognize the fact that many people's jobs no longer exist or are not open or are not safe. And, you know, the president and the Senate had no problem allocating $500 billion under Steve Mnuchin's leadership. He doesn't even want to reveal the corporations that are getting billions and billions of dollars, but yet they're going to quibble over the average American having $600 a week extra for their unemployment.
So what is the status of negotiations between Democrats and Republicans right now?
The status is that we're waiting for the Senate to act. We're waiting for Trump to give Mitch McConnell permission to act. As you know, negotiations continue. The Senate isn't even involved in the negotiations. The Senate is not even present in the room. It is Speaker Pelosi negotiating directly with the White House through Steve Mnuchin. And people should really understand the only reason any part of our government is functioning at all is because of the leadership of Speaker Pelosi.
How optimistic are you that a deal's going to happen? And when do you think that could even possibly happen?
Well, I know a deal will happen. What I hate, though, is that I don't know how much longer the American people are going to have to suffer for no good reason. The Democrats on the House side have agreed to compromise, have agreed to lower the amount that they're asking. The Republicans refuse to go up. So essentially, if we settled today, if we just compromised today, there would be no relief for local cities. There would be no relief for states, which means that firefighters, health workers are literally going to be laid off. Their jobs will be at risk. And the average American will not receive the money that the average American needs to receive.
I want to turn to an issue that is really forefront of mind for a lot of Black Americans like myself and many across this country, that you spearheaded a police reform bill that passed the House. You called it the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. The Senate has been working on its own bill. Where do things stand right now with these bills?
Well, the Senate put forward a bill that did not get to vote. If the Senate does pass a bill, which is possible because Senator Scott is considering a new bill, if there are two bills, then we go into formal negotiations in the form of a conference, if there are two bills. But right now, we're waiting to see if the Senate comes up with another bill.
The Black Lives Matter movement here in LA has also been calling to defund the LAPD and the Sheriff's Department. Where do you stand on the defund the police conversation?
Well, I say it differently. I say refund the communities, and I absolutely support refunding the communities. And what that means to me is putting resources in to deal with homelessness, to deal with addiction, to deal with mental illness, to deal with the social, economic, and health problems that really contribute to the police inappropriately arresting people. For example, in downtown LA, we have Twin Towers, which we call the country's most expensive health facility. So I think that we need to put more money into addressing the root causes of problems. And this is something that I have fought for over 30 years.
I know that you've been very supportive of Joe Biden's decision to pick Kamala Harris to be his running mate. But you've been in the national spotlight as one of the finalists, and a lot of California Democrats supported you for that job. What has that whole process, what was that like for you?
Well, it was a process that I was very honored to be a part of, honored and humbled. I mean, as you can imagine, the idea to even be considered. But one of the things that was also very humbling and an honor about the process was the other women that were all up for the same position. It was an amazing group of women, most of whom I know, many of whom I call my friends. And so I think it was us cheering each other on, whichever one got picked. we're happy for and we are definitely going to close ranks and support. And I think that the evidence of what we've seen over just these last few days, the excitement that Kamala Harris has generated on the ticket, I believe is going to be very important to us winning the election.
You said many of you are friends. I imagine what those conversations will be like between all of you in the coming days and weeks and months. I know that there's some feeling that this has kind of given a new boost to your political career. Do you think that you'll be running to take over the seat in the Senate should Kamala Harris become vice president in November or in January?
My sole focus is on these next 80 days. I want to look at what many opportunities might be. One of the things that the vice president said to all of us along the way is that he thought that there was the potential for us to play roles in the administration. So I will be exploring everything. But for the next 80 days, I only have one agenda item, period.
Understood. A personal question for me. How and when did you find out that it wasn't going to be you in the VP spot? And what was that moment like?
Well, on the same day that that everybody was notified, the vice president called. But, you know, I mean, to me, it is just so important that we stay focused and that we not allow people to divide us. So one of the things that's happening right now is the attacks on, I mean, certainly there's attacks on Biden, but there are specific attacks on Kamala Harris that I believe could well be attempts to depress the African-American vote. And I think we have to be very cognizant of that. Now, we didn't understand it 4 years ago. We do understand it now. We understand that the Russians were very clearly involved in trying to dissuade Black people from voting, saying there's no difference between Hillary and Trump. And I think the same thing is going to happen again. Now, I'm not saying it's all coming from the Russians. I have no doubt that they are playing a role. That was documented. They brought us in classified briefings to tell us about it. But some of that can be replicated and retweeted, repeated by people who are innocently have a dispute. And I think that we have to really beware any effort to look at our ticket negatively.
Congresswoman Bass represents parts of South and West LA. I really appreciate you being here. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
You're back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Jared Hill. Illegal jailhouse informants, denied justice for shooting victims, calls for resignation. OC District Attorney Todd Spitzer is facing it all. It's time for this week's Orange County Line. When he was running for DA, Spitzer excoriated the office for its part in the snitch scandal. Then there's the Seal Beach shooting of 2011. He also criticized the prosecutors in that case. Then last year, he showed up at the party when two of those prosecutors retired.
I work with these fine gentlemen. I have nothing but respect and admiration for them. There was evidence in their case that they were responsible for that came to light that had nothing to do with them. And they were really unfairly blamed. And they took a lot of responsibility on their shoulders that was completely inappropriate.
And now Spitzer's facing calls to resign. Gustavo Arellano writes for the LA Times, and every week he's here with KCRW's Orange County Line. Hola, Gustavo.
Hola, Jared.
So let's start with the jailhouse informants case. An appeals court last week overturned a previous decision. It found that informants have been permitted to threaten to kill defendants if they don't confess to a crime. How did we even get to this point?
Because it's Orange County. Come on, Jared. You know this.
Gotcha.
Okay, so this goes back way, way, way back to that Seal Beach salon massacre, the worst massacre in Orange County history. The murderer, Scott DeCry, he confessed right there on the scene, I did this case. And so you think it's an easy, easy, easy slam dunk case for the office of then District Attorney Tony Rakakis. But he illegally used jailhouse informants. So his entire case, the Rakakis' office gets recused from it. The jailhouse informant scandal turns into this huge thing that takes down both Rakakis in 2018, replaced with Spitzer, and also longtime Sheriff Sandra Hutchins. So you're still seeing the legal ramifications of this slowly winding through. In this particular case, you have the survivors of some of the victims suing the Orange County District Attorney's Office and saying, we want a full understanding of when the District Attorney and the Sheriff's Department uses snitches for their cases. And so the at one point, the District Attorney's Office, or still to this day, say, oh, you know, we're doing it fine. This was the previous administration. But now with this appeals court decision, they're going to go back to the Superior Court and say, okay, let's really examine what can be done about this, because, yeah, you can't have informants allegedly threatening to kill other people.
So it sounds like the situation hasn't really gotten much better since Spitzer took over.
Well, with Spitzer, I mean, I feel for the guy. I really do, because here's a guy who wanted to be district attorney forever. He's legendary in Orange County, infamous even for trying to climb up to his goal. And now he finally got it. But what happened with the previous administration, it's like an anchor falling on the district attorney's office, weighing down on him. And so he says he's really, truly trying to do everything possible to be better than what Tony Rakakis did. But then you have something like this. So he's saying what his spokespeople are saying is like, no, we don't need this. The lawsuit doesn't even need to go forward because we're perfectly fine on this. We've moved beyond Rakakis. So then you have this video where Todd Spitzer is praising two of the prosecutors who were part of the whole jailhouse informant scandal, saying, hey, you know, you guys were misrepresented and we stand by you. And so the victim or the survivors of the victims of that Seal Beach massacre are saying, hey, Todd, you were saying one thing when you're running. Now you have, we have you on videotape that you didn't think would see day saying something else. We're not going to stand for this. You're no longer our advocate. And frankly, we want you gone.
So you touched on the Seal Beach shooting just a little bit ago. But those victims now, last week they started calling for Spitzer to resign. But this happened all the way back in 2011. Can we talk about those calls for resignation now?
Yeah, so it's really heartbreaking for a lot of these people. The main advocate for this is Paul Wilson. So Paul Wilson, his wife got killed in the Seal Beach massacre. He was one of the strongest voices throughout the entire trial. He actually appeared in a campaign video for Todd Spitzer, where Paul Wilson said, Todd Spitzer is going to bring back integrity to the district attorney's office. And now he's the one who's calling for Todd's resignation louder than anyone, saying, Todd betrayed me, we were friends, and now this happened. The spokesperson for the district attorney's office not only, of course, denied all the allegations that Wilson and others said, but then she accused Paul Wilson of basically advocating for a campaign for Scott Sanders to run for county district attorney, which came as a huge surprise to everyone, because never once has Sanders ever said he wants to run for district attorney, at least publicly.
Interesting. So we're pressed for time here, but lastly, why the 180, and do you think he's going to resign?
No, Todd's not going to resign. Not at all. Again, he's going to continue with this case. He's going to continue. He really believes himself to be the man on a white horse. With the 180, he actually says is that at the time, he didn't know that they were actually as deep in the muck with the snitch scandal, the two prosecutors that he praised, as he did during the video. But I mean, I'm not going to insinuate anything with Todd, but I also see these are two people that he knew for decades. He was invited to the retirement party. He's not going to trash them. He thought he was in front of a friendly crowd, and he was, but he didn't know that someone in that crowd had something against Todd. And of course, now you release the tape and here we are.
Wow. Gustavo Arellano writes for the LA Times and is a regular here on Greater LA. Gustavo, very interesting. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Gracias.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is a show for us today. We appreciate you being here. Tomorrow, we'll be talking more about back to school time and some of the businesses that are losing out in the new world of online education. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Share your thoughts with us. Let us know what you think about it. If you missed any parts of this show or any past shows, you can check out the podcast there. Make sure to subscribe while you're there. kcrw.com/greaterLA. Have a great day. We'll see you next time.